You're listening to the ILFD podcast, where we take a dive into the International Literature Festival Dublin archives and share some of our favorite conversations from years past. Today, for our final episode of 2023, we're listening back to Kirsty Bell discussing her book, The Undercurrents, with moderator Helen Meaney, from the 25th anniversary edition of the festival back in 2022.
It's fantastic to be here at this festival in person, unlike the last 2 years where we were on our screens, and to welcome Kirsty Bell to Dublin. It's a great pleasure to meet you. Having read The Undercurrents in the last few weeks and been utterly swept away. Now, I'm going to go easy on the river and watery metaphors, but just to say it had a momentum which really surprised me. There's a sense of a quest in the book, which, you know, it takes, yes, it does meander, but it comes back and it circles on itself. But what keeps you really gripped is this sense of you trying to discover something that's going to make sense to you of a feeling of unease with which the book begins, and a sense that things have gone, there's a malaise and something has gone awry, both in your life, and you're also trying to find how that is reflected in Berlin, your adopted city. There are so many different layers to it, and different ways in, and as we go through, you start to explore not only the history of Berlin, but also the cultural history through writers, many of whom I didn't know, which was a delight, and through diaries and letters and reportage. So it becomes this kind of bricolage almost. And you described your method as being like a seamstress, and I was very taken by that. So we might come back to how you actually put it all together, because there's a lot, so many things going on. But Kirsty, first of all, would you like to tell us a little bit about where the quest began, from your apartment, looking out your window, and how you started to think about your place in the city of Berlin?
Thank you for that introduction, Helen. Yes, it did have to do with this kind of coincidence of things like somehow at a crossroads in my own life, at a moment of personal crisis, and some kind of sense of disorientation or what was, you used a great word that I can't remember now at the beginning, but some kind of menace, and then realizing that this kind of internal sensation that I was trying to come to terms with was then mirrored in the cityscape around me. And this became kind of particularly clear because I just moved into a new apartment. So I had a new perspective on the city that I'd already been living in for 13, 14 years. And I previously lived in the former east of the city and then had moved to this apartment in a new building, or not a new building, a new apartment to me in an old building on the banks of the Landwehr Canal, which runs through Berlin. And so I was kind of coming to terms with the breakup of my marriage and the feelings of disorientation that brought with it. And at the same time, I kind of found myself being drawn to the view outside the window of this apartment that's on the water. It's in the west of the city, but it looks out towards the east and towards this kind of patch of landscape that in former times was the kind of beating heart of the city, and it had since gone through many different transformations.
Yes, and it's beautiful the way you keep coming back to the canal, actually, even as we go through the decades from, you know, mid to late 19th century, right through the Weimar period, through the Second World War and on, and some terrible things that happened in the canal. So you come back to that and that immediacy of the physical. And it's like obviously the history of Berlin is such a huge subject, but you're not actually trying to do that. You're bringing it down to something much more grounded. I mean, physically, literally, the streets, the land, the fact that Berlin was built on a swamp, and, you know, that there's that sense of the high water table, being close to being close to the canal, but also that you start by feeling that water is invading your apartment, actually, and that's how it's like something uneasy is manifesting itself physically in the building. And I wonder, would you like to read that, because that will give everyone a sense of your introduction to the book and where you began. That opening, that passage, that
Thank
would be
you.
Great.
I'll just read a couple of pages from the introduction to the book, the prelude, which makes more sense in kind of trying to condense what actually happened. So, a large pool of water had appeared overnight on our kitchen floor. So silent and unexpected, it seemed to be a mirage. Tap water had been dribbling from a loose pipe beneath the sink and leaking noiselessly down through the two stories below us. This scene, which we woke up to on the morning of our son's 9th birthday, was the most dramatic, but not the only incident of water damage. For several months before and after, a collection of plastic buckets and basins had become a semi-permanent wandering feature, brought out to catch leaks in different parts of our home. One evening, a few months after the kitchen flood, our elder son noticed water dripping from the plasterwork rosette in the center of the living room ceiling. Looking up, we saw an ominous spreading patch of brown as water leaking from upstairs traversed the terrain above our heads. Water always finds its way. My sons and I fetched the buckets and basins once more and laid out towels to soak it up. It was as if our new apartment was trying to tell us something. The apartment we'd lived in before on the east side of the city, with an Edenic plasterwork of vines, fruits and flowers twisting around the columns of its facade, exerted no such influence. We were there for 10 years, husband and wife, two sons, two cats. And throughout this time, regardless of our difficulties, that apartment was consistently neutral. It did not make its presence felt or stir up any overt feelings. It was simply a container, benevolent, if anything, in enabling the maintenance of the status quo. Our new apartment, closer to the boys' school in the West, was awkward from day one. Aggravating and interfering, it kept producing warning signals that could not be ignored. It intervened and forced itself into the role of the protagonist. There are things you can see and others you can only feel that you sense in a different way, as a whisper in your mind or a weight in your bones. A nugget of doubt had crystallized and been disturbing the everyday flow of my thoughts for weeks already. Like a silty clot of debris, its vague contours had gained definition when we moved east to west across the axis of the city. Its shape was of unhappiness. And now here it was, clotting up my mind as I paced between the rooms of our extravagantly proportioned new home. A cultivated emptiness in the mind can allow for rippling, drift, and snag. It can draw out things that don't want to be seen. That early morning encounter with a glassy pool of water on the kitchen floor was an unequivocal sign of rupture. Something had broken its banks and could no longer be contained. After years of emotional repression, subconsciously practiced to maintain a functional family life, this spontaneous display, this uncalled-for outburst, this flood, was a symbol of almost hysterical clarity. It asked for an equally extreme response, which duly came in a sudden, brutal, and final break, a severing of the family unit, whereby one part was broken off, and the other three parts remained together. My husband went away for work and never came back to our home. Water always finds its way, winding through the crevices of this old building, seeping into smoothly plastered and painted surfaces, appearing suddenly in damp bruises of mold in high up corners, inducing patches of plasterwork to blister off external walls. There was always a logical explanation, a cause to put it down to: heavy rainfall on unsealed roof tiles, pipes drilled into or fixed up faultily, blocked drains in overflowing showers. The builders at work on the penthouse upstairs were clearly a slapdash bunch. Still, the relentlessness of these various cases began to feel oppressive. It was as if the surfaces of the apartment refused to be sealed. Its infrastructure would not hold tight. Whenever it rained, I was anxious. As the months progressed, I felt an urge to map out the stains and marks that had been left on the ceilings, walls, and floors. If I were to plot out their topography, could I devise a map to read and make sense of these minor domestic disasters?
Thank you.
Stop there.
Thank you. I think that gives us a sense of just how beautiful it is and how everything is full of symbolism for you at that moment. And you spoke about the rupture in your, so this is in your family life and your personal life and your relationship, and that somehow that propels you on this, I suppose, the initially an archival research journey into finding out more about the building, because you're trying to find out, well, what on earth is wrong with it and how to separate it from you, or whether that's possible. And I'm just so impressed by your research, your archival abilities and talents. So could you tell us a little bit about where you started in trying to find out about the building and more importantly about who had lived there before? And you're trying to see, is there something that they've left behind that is affecting you or influencing you?
It was a kind of quest in a way, I didn't feel like it was a quest at the time, but it was definitely a searching, and I didn't really know what it was I was searching for, but I just had a very kind of strong propulsion that I wanted to find out what this house was, who were the previous inhabitants, how it ended up there. And so the first thing I did was to go to the land registry office and look through the records of the building, you know, really just to see what would spring out. And then immediately, I think because I was so sensitized at that moment in a way, because there had been so many major changes in my life, and I think I was just kind of searching for meaning in everything, you know.
Yeah.
And immediately found documents from the family who'd lived there before, the family called Sala, who had lived in the house and had print works in the back, you know, like these typical Berlin buildings from this period of the founding years of Berlin around 1870, had a big kind of grand building on the front and then courtyards in the back with factory buildings. And this family Sala had a print works there. And when we'd actually found the apartment, the name Sala had still been written in big letters across the front of the building. So that was immediately something that kind of caught my interest. And then one of the first documents I found was a document of adoption, that a child had been adopted by Bruno and Charlotte Sala, who were living in the building at the time, and that she'd been adopted in 1942, which clearly, if you're living in the centre of Berlin, was a kind of a very special kind of time to be adopting a child. So then this child, whose name was Melita, became this kind of figure of mystery for me. Who was she? Why was she being adopted? Was there some kind of tragic circumstances, and was it related to the war? And so that was began this other kind of sub-quest.
Yes, it's a thread. Yes. And at one point you think you say that she's a protagonist of the book. So it's like, but she's there. And we find out more about her as we go along. But what's interesting, though, is the way your research and your search really takes you in so many different directions. And one of the really central subjects of the book actually is the development of the urban design and plan, the city plan for Berlin, going back to the 19th century. And that's just so fascinating in terms of what happened, what might have happened. And you're able to trace the canal and your whole area on maps that you find in the archives and so on. And it seems to me that that is something that is really important to you and becomes a sort of a parallel track in the book, and right through, and then it's a way of going through the war and the reconstruction and then the reunification or the unification of Germany. And I wonder, could you say a little bit about that and your how you became so drawn to trying to understand the shape and form and evolution of Berlin?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with this with this particular frame, because I ended up using essentially the frame, the view out of my window, my kitchen window. So the kitchen window frame became this kind of frame through which to look at the city, And like you were saying earlier, Berlin is an enormous city and its history is so long and complicated. And, to begin a project is writing about the history of Berlin is kind of insane. But I kind of kept clicking back to just the actual physical things that I could see through this cutout, and through that device, I suppose I became interested in thinking, like, what would this view have been like in the years immediately when the building had been built, or what would it have been like at the turn of the century, and I think it was that just. Kind of that imagination, like trying to just project these different versions of this particular view. And I mean, I think the part of it was I had this idea of the house being some kind of witness, trying to understand what this building had actually witnessed, and perhaps to think of the window as an eye, and in that sense, like what were the things that had taken place. And then as I started to kind of analyze this view from the window as if it was a painting or something, I come from art criticism, so it was, I suppose, something that just felt very close to me, this kind of close reading of this particular view. And I started to kind of pull the different elements apart, beginning with the canal, which itself was designed by Peter Joseph Lenné, who was a very important landscape architect who designed Berlin's Tiergarten Park and had was kind of the first city planner. He developed the first plans for the city in the mid-1800s. And so that kind of brought me into this idea of city planning and visionary city planners, because Peter Joseph Lenné, who came from landscape architecture, had an incredible vision for the city at this particular time in its history when it was going through this rapid urban expansion and its population was growing unbelievably rapidly. Yeah. And he realized that the effects of industrialization would have to be counterbalanced by plenty of greenery and by this beautiful canal, like lined with these kind of promenading alleyways. And he had kind of planted tens of thousands of trees in the city and had this, a vision for what the city could become. That wasn't realized, because in the end the railways became so important that his kind of vision for greenery and leisure time was just completely eradicated by these kind of huge spreading railway yards, which are also very in very close proximity to this house that I was living in. So from the house's perspective, it went from living on this very bucolic kind of pastoral canalway with this quite small railway station across the canal on the other side to this railway station becoming this kind of huge motor for the development of Berlin as kind of this central node of railway transport in Europe. And so with it, the whole urban landscape kind of turned a corner and went in a different direction.
Yeah, I mean, I found that as a way of tracing the history of Berlin, it was just it really was so eloquent, and that idea of this, he was ahead of his time, really, wasn't he? I mean, we could do with him now that learning that view of the green spaces being essential to city life, and then that was swept away, and I think what comes out of the book is how one individual, how important in the urban design and planning of a city one individual is, that could be overturned. I've forgotten the name now of his successor who was all about sorting out the sewage but in fact the living conditions with all of that overpopulation and rapid industrialization, that people were living in terrible conditions and slums, and that was a direct result of decisions taken. And I think that's what really comes out in your writing, that understanding of all these things are connected.
I think I'm just really fascinated by the sense of what we live in and what effect it has on us and how it came to be that, you know, because all of these successions of decisions that are taken by an individual or proposed by an individual and then not taken result in the landscape that we live in and that also we're profoundly affected by, you know, that we're profoundly affected by landscape, by street planning, by whether or not there are trees planted there, you know, and in Berlin, of course, that's extremely palpable. Within this 20 years that I've been living there, because there's been so much that's changed and so many decisions that have been made that, and so it's kind of gone from this situation of being kind of full of this incredible potential manifest in huge building sites everywhere to the building sites disappearing and the potential disappearing with it, because there's just these very unremarkable buildings left in the space where the hole and the cranes were.
Yes, and it seemed as almost as if there's an echo in what's happened in the last, say, 20 years or so since the fall of the wall and all that great opportunity, which I think you've described as it was a squandered opportunity. But that sort of seems to echo what was happening in the late 19th century with the swerve away in terms of the city plan. And I found that very, very interesting that these cycles repeat themselves. And I mean, you're pretty critical of some of the new architecture in Berlin that we would be familiar with around Potsdamer Platz, and I think you call it a void. And there's a sense of that disappointment in some of the new urban development that comes out towards the end of the book. And I wonder what you feel about the immediate future now of Berlin as a city to live in and be in. I'm going to come back to the historical part in a second, but
I think all cities are difficult places to be in at the moment, to be honest. But I think with Berlin, the development has been so rapid that it feels quite it's quite traumatic to experience. But the very positive aspect of living in Berlin is that there's this incredible, like, deeply rooted political activism that kind of, in some cases, manages to hold on the reins of these kind of development projects that are trying to be put into place. You know, so there have been cases where terrible plans for terrible buildings have been stopped by these kind of grassroots activism. But then the difficulty, of course, with that is that as rents become more expensive, it becomes much more difficult to find the time to invest in grassroots activism. So it's a kind of critical point at the moment.
Yeah. Well, it's very familiar. We're very familiar with all of those issues here right now. That whole use of your use of deployment of sort of the urban development and the history of the physical fabric of the city, you then return to the writers and artists who lived there, say, from the late 19th century. And there are a few who are particularly important to you, I think. Fontaine and also Walter Benjamin, Joseph Roth. Could you say a little bit about how you were drawn to, how did you choose the particular writers who became sort of almost like witnesses to your story?
Also, I mean, very banal, really, because they were all writing about this area. They all lived in this area where I lived, in a little bit further up the canal in the Tiergarten area. That's where Benjamin lived and where, as a child, and his fantastic book about his childhood around 1900 is all set in those streets, you know. And there's these descriptions of him traveling in a carriage down the canal and crossing over the bridge to go to the Anhalter Bahnhof to go and visit his relatives in the country. And that's, you know, I can see all of that from my window, you know. Yeah. So there was this kind of real, just the thrill of proximity, you know, in reading those accounts. And the same with Theodor Fontana, you know, and his famous books, Effie Briest, when she was living in Berlin, was all set around there. And Theodor Fontana himself lived there in a succession of different apartments that were all just kind of a stone's throw from where I live. So, I mean, in a way, that's very banal, but it was very fascinating, you know, to get through this idea of the eyewitness, you know, the eyewitness who, if I was trying to imagine what it could have been like at these different periods throughout the past, then by reading Fontana's novels, for instance, then I could get a really good sense of it because it's so descriptive, you know. Yeah. It's all just written in there. So I kind of had this kind of weird project of kind of reading the books in this way of just like looking for certain street names, or, you know, just like looking for areas that I recognized as a way of kind of putting together collaging together some kind of version of the past.
Yeah, I mean, it's really rich. And then you sort of, I think from that, you then say, well, where were the women writers from that period, from the sort of, you know, 1870s on? And you discover, you do yet more research, and you find some really interesting novelists. And you know, one of them was talking about the malaise and the sort of the restrictions and constraints on women in that period, and then you trace that through into the Weimar period, which of course we always think of as this great flowering of amazing cultural and artistic work, but you also find it difficult to find the women writers and women artists.
There are more of them, but they're also strangely, the thing that I mean, I wasn't really, I have to say that all of these things that I discovered, it really just came through the process of the research, you know. Ooh. It was really a lot of just kind of searching in the dark and to see where a question would lead me, like this question of like, where were the women, you know, what were they doing? And the thing that I found so fascinating about the Weimar Republic is that there's this kind of poster girl of the new woman, of the post-First World War new woman with short hair and short skirt, and there was so much apparently available, but actually that wasn't really true because there were still so many social restrictions and difficulties and prejudices around working women, also from other women. So in a way, that idea of the new woman in the Weimar period is a bit of a misnomer, and actually most of the histories of the Weimar are still kind of 80% male artists and writers and thinkers.
Yeah, I mean, and it's almost as if you're tracing a line, though, from the end of the previous century, which is about a lot to do with constraints, conventions, disapproval of women's attempt to just be free, I suppose. A very, very, very patriarchal society. And then it's just such a light touch, but you bring us through that post-First World War period and to some of the men who might have, who were fought on the Western Front and who turn into, who become almost like a militia, a sort of very violent, informal police. And then that, and then you link that with the rise of the Nazi Party. So it's just, you're tackling these major historical changes, but through, again, using a lot of eyewitness accounts. And I was particularly taken by Rosa Luxemburg and your use of her letters. And how did you find your way to Rosa Luxemburg?
Well, Rosa Luxemburg, tragically, when she was murdered by these groups of the Freikorps, these militia who had kept their weapons after the First World War, her body was thrown into the Landwehr Canal, you know. So this was also this thing that, again, was right outside my window. It sounds so boring to keep saying that, but
amazing.
This is kind of the thread that runs through it, you know. And she was, her body was thrown into the canal, but then not discovered until 5 months later, you know. And so that also had something kind of incredibly mysterious about it, and this sense of things that were supposed to be got rid of just kind of rising unbidden to the surface. But Rosa Luxemburg is such a fascinating figure in terms of, again, another, you know, what could have happened? You know, what could have happened if Rosa Luxemburg and Karl Liebknecht had not been murdered?
Yes.
You know, and
yeah.
And I just, again, wanted to get a little bit closer to what she was thinking, or I think I really just wanted to find out what she thought about Berlin. So I started reading her letters, and she has these wonderful descriptions about coming to Berlin and looking for an apartment. I think it was like right at the end of the 1800s, and how she found it such an ugly and overbearing and dominated by military men, like cold and overbearing and dominated by military men, you know. And of course, you know, the history of Berlin is so closely related to the Second World War and to Hitler and the Nazis, but, you know, that takes up so much space in our idea of it. But I was really interested in just following that trail back to see, you know, where that actually came from, like how could that have been possible, and this Prussian militarism and the prejudice and the violence and the repression associated with that, you know, that was the roots of the rise of fascism, of course.
Yeah, and so it's so interesting. And another one of your heroes, I would think, in the book is Fassbinder. And you write, we'll come back to his films in a moment, but it was so interesting to me that when he died, he was working on a screenplay about Rosa Luxemburg. So it was like, that was, everything was beginning to, and it's such a shame he didn't live long enough to make that. Yeah. But he's looking back. So he adopts Fontana's novel, Effie Briest, and he has some very interesting views on that Prussian repression that you were talking about. And I think that's something that drew you to Fassbinder then.
Well, I actually initially started looking at Fassbinder when I got to the period of Berlin during the, you know, when the wall was there, and just trying to imagine what it would have been like at that time. What did it look like? You know, what did the people look like, and how did they behave, and how did they act? And that's what took me to Fassbinder's films, many of which are, of course, set in Munich because that's where he was based. But there are a few that are set in Berlin. So again, it was that just to try and find pictures for it. And there are some fantastic films that he made set in Berlin, which are very just full of, just rich with kind of observation, social observation. But then, of course, he also made this film, which was a remake of Fontana's Effie Briest, and it has this really long and complicated subtitle. It's the title of the film is not just Effie Briest, but it's Fontana's Effie Briest, and then it has this really long and complicated subtitle, which I can't remember, but the effect of it is something like what happens when you understand the restrictions of the social milieu in which you live but do nothing about them.
Right? Yes.
So it was this kind of, on the one hand, luxuriating in this fantastic novel and these beautiful characters and this incredible piece of literature, but on the other hand, kind of criticizing Fontana for allowing his heroine to die a tragic death, particularly because in actual fact, the woman that Fontana based the Effie Briest story on did not die a tragic death after getting divorced from her husband. She, after she was divorced, she trained to be a nurse. Mm. She was working in a hospital. She fell in love with one of her patients, a woman, and they lived a happy life together, and she died in 1952.
Oh,
right. You know, so,
yeah.
So actually, you know, Fontana's view was very, confined by social stereotypes.
Yeah, so it's a critique, really, by Fassbinder.
Exactly.
Or a commentary, I suppose.
A commentary,
more.
Yeah.
Yeah, so interesting. Yeah. But you also did find other women writers who had found from the late 19th century, you'd found a sort of measure of independence. I mean, mostly they had some sort of a wealthy background or some private means. So it wasn't quite the picture that Fontana
exactly
created or presented of some doomed heroines and
exactly
a lack of choice or a lack of agency.
I just at a certain point, because I was reading so much Fontana, you know, and it was just one after another, doomed heroine after another, and I just got very frustrated about that, you know, and wanted to, you know, wanted to find out what were the women actually thinking. You know, they can't all have just been kind of confined into these doomed narratives. And I was in the library in Berlin in this beautiful 1970s building, wonderful building just around the corner from where I live. And I was reading these Fontana novels. And then I started like doing a search and came across this catalogue of women artists. It goes back to 1870, you know, and it's this huge, thick kind of encyclopedia. So, so that was then the evidence. There were a lot of women who were actually doing things, but they just, it didn't leave any trace. It's all disappeared.
Yeah, yeah, so interesting. And, I mean, the other aspect of that is sort of you going back then to try and locate the residents in your building and the kind of connecting that the role of a woman and whether, you know, what kind of life she would have had and so on. And then you go off in a very interesting, I think, a very interesting direction where you start to think about the energy almost in the building. And you consult a feng shui master, and then I think an astrologer at another time, and you're very open to all sorts of different readings of, I suppose, how an energy is retained in a building or in the ground or in land. Could you talk us a little bit about that and about that sense of, I think you talk about morphic fields and you connected with epigenetics and how trauma and pain is passed on from one generation to the next.
I mean, I think it began because because of the situation in my apartment, which felt very, it just felt very loaded and weird because of all of these episodes of water damage,
yeah.
One after the other. And, you know, when you get to the 12th episode, you think this is not just a plumbing problem. So, I also wanted to make some changes in the apartment, and I was not really sure what to do. And so I found this feng shui person, just as an idea to see what would, you know, just to see. I was quite curious to see what she would say. And she came in, and I was really, you know, I have no understanding of feng shui at all, and I was thinking that she would just tell me to, you know, put a plant here or a mirror there, and,
yes,
you know, those kind of things. But actually, when she came into the apartment, that she started talking about energy, you know, and how certain rooms in the apartment were very laden with this kind of energy, and you know, the the parts where she sensed that were definitely the parts that I knew were problematic. And she started talking about history, you know, and that it had to do with the past and it had to do with history. And, you know, and I just found that really fascinating as a way of reading, you know, as a way of another way of reading things that aren't visible, you know, how to access those things that you know are there, but that are not manifest in a visual way. And that just really connected with how I feel about the city. That there is a particular energy in the city that is, well, I lived in New York before I came to Berlin, and that just as a very bold comparison, you know, New York has a very different kind of energy. And when I found out that New York is built on bedrock, this very, very hard, solid ground, and Berlin is built on a swamp, this very, very porous, sandy ground, then that seemed to make a lot of sense, you know, from a geological point of view. And then so I started looking more into feng shui and understanding that it actually has to do with geology. It has to do with the nature of the terrain and how wind and water behave in relation to that. So actually, you know, it's very sensible. It's really just to do with observation and making wise choices. And in that sense, Berlin, from a feng shui perspective, is a terrible place. You know, it's built on terrible ground. Yeah. It's very exposed and windy. And, you know, from a feng shui perspective, you would never build your capital city there.
Yeah, I mean that's not the popular understanding of feng shui at all, is it? So I was really interested in that, and I do think that you're making a connection between that idea about energy, and then when you write about the post-war period in Berlin and the fact that there was a kind of numbness and an inability to for people to really process what had happened, even though the evidence of the past was all around them and of the war, but it was sort of it was unspoken about and was very difficult to broach. And then in the late 60s, there was a book written about trauma, mm-hmm. about intergenerational trauma and how to, by psychoanalysts, talking mm-hmm. about how to make a reckoning with the past. And that was hugely then important. And could you say a little bit about that, and you think the influence of that work?
Yeah, it's a book written in 1967 by two psychoanalysts whose name was Michelisch, a husband and wife. And they wrote this book called The Inability to Mourn that was specifically about the generation of Germans who'd been either young children during the war years or already grown up and had not were not adequately equipped to come to terms with the trauma of what had actually happened, you know. And there's many it's a very complicated issue because there's also many reasons for that tied up with you know, the shame of being the perpetrators, you know, that it kind of leads to this kind of quandary of, you know, can you be a victim if you are also ostensibly the perpetrators? But that was a real watershed moment, this book about kind of reckoning with the past. But it's also something that, you know, it wasn't solved at that point. You know, it's an ongoing problem. And there's now been this, you know, with this recent developments in epigenetic research and understanding how trauma is inherited. You know, and there's been some really fascinating books written in Germany specifically about children in the war and also grandchildren of the war, so who didn't actually experience it themselves, who were born, say, in the late 50s or 60s, but who have inherited the trauma of their parents, but don't understand what it is because it's never been spoken about.
Yes, and you know, I mean, I suppose you've got somebody like Sebald writing about that, and it just seems to be something that's coming, that the whole subject of trauma is becoming much more sort of widely recognized under the intergenerational aspect of it. I mean,
thanks for listening to the ILFD podcast. International Literature Festival Dublin is a Dublin City Council initiative kindly supported by the Arts Council.